off today. That's right.
You've got questions? Hopefully I will have answers. Yes.
Okay, I'm wondering the relationship between efficiency in regards to an insurer. Like on page 14.
Yeah. It's what's the question there? 14 or 15?
Is the negligence standard the superior to the standard that makes the defendant liable as insurer?
Right. Well, and again, the whole question is, you know, superior by what standard? So, you know, one argument would be it's superior from the standpoint of efficiency, that it encourages the right balance of safety and risk taking. So, I mean, this gets kind of far afield, and I'll try to limit it here so it doesn't get too far afield. But the Chicago School of Economics, the Posnerians and those types, have basically said that legal rules are an attempt to provide the most efficient rules so that we get the biggest bang for our buck. And they've argued generally that negligence is a superior rule because it not only encourages the defendant to use the optimal amount of safety, but it also encourages the plaintiff to use the optimal amount of safety because the plaintiff gets dinged for failing to avoid those injuries that the plaintiff could have avoided. And the plaintiff stays away from those injuries where reasonable care can't avoid them. So if the tanker truck is going down the street, I will stay away from it. Whereas if I know, gee, they're strictly liable, I don't really care if they overturn and blow up because I know I or my heirs will be compensated for it. Now, again, the Chicago School has a sort of, interesting way of looking at the world in which things are nicely reduced to sort of costs and, you know, values and so forth. I think it's at that point that the people have some skepticism about the ability of the Posnerian worldview to really explain legal rules, and that you need at least on some in some balancing fashion a perspective that is non-utilitarian, that operates on sort of a principle of fairness that says, gee, I don't know what's efficient or not, but I know what's fair. So, again, these are kind of think questions here to have you ponder the meaning of the universe and how tort law can be put together in one grand conceptual whole. But, to the extent that at least some of you are trying to figure out how to do well on Monday, it's not the kind of thing my client is going to turn to me, and say, yes, but if tort law changed to a system of holding these people liable as insurers, wouldn't that change the state of affairs? If, your client's going to be more interested in how are things handled right now, and these sort of think questions are a way of giving you a broader perspective,
on injunction,
ordinarily the plaintiff's entitled to an injunction as well as past damages. So in both Boomer and in Dell Webb's Spur Industries, in both of those cases, there were kind of odd circumstances that led the court to kind of look for something outside the box. But the ordinary right of the plaintiff, if what's going on next to me is a nuisance. Again, I'm downtown. The building owner next to me has allowed his property to become dilapidated, and it's become a, you know, a needle park there, and everybody knows it as such, and my restaurant business is going to hell because of the poor quality of the neighborhood. If that, in fact, is classified as a nuisance, then I'm entitled not only to the damages that have been caused, but to an injunction that forces the person to do something about it. Well, I think there were two things. The first was a kind of, here again, it's the deference of one of the judge in this case, not we've seen before in Hammond III versus Jenner, where the court felt as though it owed some deference to the legislature, say maybe we should have a special rule for automobile drivers who have health conditions that impair their ability to drive, but if there's going to be a rule like that, it really ought to come from the legislature. Those people are more competent to resolve those sorts of issues. Until they decide to change the rule, we're going to follow the one that's been given to us. Here, the deference, or in Boomer, the deference was toward the executive to say, gee, there are these, you know, people in this agency that are a lot more technologically gifted than we are. They can hold hearings, and you know, they've got economists and scientists and all these different people, and they know how to evaluate the seriousness of air pollution and figure out what technology needs to be used and when we can apply it, etc. If I, as a judge, try to work all that stuff out, I'm not nearly as well equipped as they are. And so again, the kind of larger mega policy issue is, when do you want the judge to go into this deferential mode and say, gee, you know, I can tell you what cases say in the Constitution, statutes, and that's my job, but in terms of this other kind of stuff, I'm really not very well equipped, and why don't you go to the other branches of government that are more adept than I? You may think that's a good thing. You may think, well, your faith is touching but misplaced. These other branches of government are worse off than you are because they may have the technical expertise, but they're boxed in by all this, you know, political pressure and so forth and so on. You alone have the ability to slice the Gordian knot and finally get us moving. So, you know, the kind of example of Brown versus Board of Education where, gee, you know, if we left it to the political branches to, you know, this is the kind of thing that could only be done by, you know, a sort of dramatic Olympian act. So, again, as you sort of look across, we encounter at various places this same argument where one party is telling the court, do the right thing, in Spike Lee's phrase, or people are telling the court, hey, you may think this is a good thing, but remember you're just a judge, and your authority is more limited. And we'll see the court sometimes going this way and sometimes going that way. And as you evaluate, you know, thinking about, again, these larger questions of what do we want, for example, the Supreme Court to do? What are we expecting the president's nominees to the Supreme Court to think in terms of the role of the Supreme Court? Is it the Supreme Court's job to, you know, decide questions, big social questions, affirmative action, yada, 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 or is the court's job a kind of a last resort where if the other things, you know, if they're stuck with it, yeah, of course they do it, but as long as other branches of the government seem, or states seem to be doing okay, then they're supposed to be more deferential. Again, that's We see it in a less politicized form in courts, but it's kind of the same issue about formulating a standard for when the court's going to do one. I started to say there were two reasons. One is this deference issue, the sort of humility of recognizing another branch may be better at it. The other reason was the equitable one of saying, to the extent that the injunction is an equitable remedy, there is a mixed pattern here where the defendant's making of this, you know, huge plant was done at a time when everybody thought, you go, girl. Great. Everybody's for it, and now people have a different idea. But there is a certain, you know, it's not as though on their own they decided to build this thing, and now they, you know. So I think there was this kind of sympathy with the defendant. Again, that may have been misplaced, or it may have been justified, but. That's why the court was divided there. Yes.
And I was just hoping you could elaborate on some of the comments.
Right. Well, Fletcher's idea was that, and it's really kind of an explanation, this idea of an abnormally dangerous activity, that first of all, in his namesake, Rylands versus Fletcher, as it happens, anyway. Okay, so the in that case, whichever the middle opinion is, I can't remember who wrote the middle opinion, but the one that picks up Bramwell's dissent. The judge points out the difference between the rights of a guy sitting at home having his mind flooded with his neighbor's water as distinguished from people who travel out on the highway. So that when you go out on the highway, you're imposing a risk on the people next to you and they're imposing a risk on you. And again, we find that the more efficient rule is to say, the standard here is that of reasonable care. If you use reasonable care and an accident happens, that's you're not liable for that. A rule of strict liability out on the highway would be less efficient. I think that's the thought. But that's only true to the extent that our risks are reciprocal. I impose a risk on you, you impose a risk on me. Even if it's not two cars sitting next to each other driving down the highway together, but it's me and an 18-wheeler, we're still roughly in the same ballpark. What Fletcher is saying is there comes a point at which the risk is so non-reciprocal that whereas the risk he imposes on me with his 10,000 gallons of gas is way out of proportion to the risk that I impose upon him, it makes sense for us to leave the rule of reasonable care and say, with respect to the risk you now impose on me, there really isn't any kind of return thing that I'm doing to you. And at that point, strict liability makes sense. Anyway, that's kind of the nutshell version of his argument as to why this difference in the treatment makes sense and is explainable, again, not just as a matter of pity or, you know, law spreading or something else, but it's really based upon a kind of principle of justice or fairness. Fletcher, by the way, wrote a very influential book called Rethinking Criminal Law. I don't know if it's used at all anymore, but yeah. Other questions? Yes.
Well, I have a question directly about the what you would prefer to have a site, like in writing our analysis and would you prefer having would you like to have the case that we did in classroom?
No. again, my standard is I'm looking over your shoulder as you're sort of talking to a client or you're writing out a sort of client letter. You don't have to put it in the form of, you know, "Dear Mrs. Smith, it was so nice to meet you the other day." You know, you can skip that part of it. But in terms of the sort of information that you provide, it is the kind of thing that you would provide to a client. So in terms of giving your client the big picture of saying, you know, I like to have in the beginning, and you'll notice in all the checklists that I have, the first item is an overview to kind of paint the big picture, which accomplishes several things. Number one, it gives your reader a kind of, you know, is the old classic, tell them what you're going to tell them, then you tell them, then you tell them what you told them. You know, the overview tells your reader what to expect. And number two, it keeps you on track. So that to the extent at the beginning you've identified, okay, here are the kinds of things I'm going to cover, in virtually any exam, one of your criteria is time management. So figuring out how to allocate how much time you're going to spend on different aspects of it, sort of doing an inventory at the beginning of where you're going is useful. And so in the beginning you would say, to recover, if you're addressing the plaintiff, you would say, to recover in this case, we'd have to establish that the defendant breached a duty. That can be done, or we would do that either by showing that they acted negligently or that their conduct is subject to some form of strict liability. You know, and then you talk about negligence, you talk about strict liability, etc. So, again, in the tone of it, it's explaining to them stuff that they will need to know to kind of connect the dots and put it all together. But then once you get into explaining, well, you know, to establish negligence, we might use the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur. Res ipsa loquitur is applied when blah, 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 blah. Rather than saying, citing a case as though you're writing to a judge, you would simply explain it. So here are the elements of a res ipsa loquitur case. And then in the classic IRAC method, I think res ipsa might apply, issue, rule. You know, res ipsa is composed of these elements, application. This element applies, this element doesn't apply. Conclusion, therefore, good theory, bad theory. What, you know, useful, not useful, etc. So again, the meat of it is going to be in the form of explaining how you think this would help or hurt, all of this tending in the end toward that big C conclusion, you know, the gigantic sort of IRAC issue, will I be able to recover, will I, you know, do I, am I vulnerable to suit if you represent the defendant, rule, you know, and issues and so forth, conclusion, we're looking good, this is a loser, you know, it depends, you know, it largely depends on the outcome of this. So, but that's what your, you know, your client is wanting from you, an answer to that question. Well, how would you assess my case? Should we be optimistic, pessimistic? Where are the good, strong points, where are the weak points? So, to that end, you're not as much either addressing this to a judge who will expect, you know, case citations, nor are you addressing it to a law professor who wants to know the interesting theoretical, you know, latest fads and theories in academia. You're addressing it to a client who simply wants to know. Now, that isn't to say that occasionally you won't have, you know, time to do some exotic little thing, just as I, again, in the practice of medicine, it may be that my case presented to the physician says, well, you know, I just read this article in a medical journal that says there's a new medication that's out that may address your problem. I don't know anything about it, but I'll go find out about it and so forth. So occasionally the cutting edge of this stuff would be relevant, but as distinguished from impressing your fellow wizards, who are professionals at this, your primary job is to is to make it comprehensible to a client and help them make those tough decisions they have to make about getting their checkbook out and writing a check or what have you. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm going to go back to negligence.
Sure, that's fine.
I'm wondering if you can give me the short end of what's admissible in determining negligence in regards to the rule.
Okay. The ordinary rule is that remedial measures taken after the accident are presumptively inadmissible. So no matter how luscious that piece of evidence is, you can't get it unless you fall into one of these exceptions. And the exceptions are basically triggered by the defendant's choice to make it relevant in some way. So, for example, the defendant says, wasn't my property, wasn't my stuff, denies ownership or control over the thing that caused the accident. Or the owner says, oh, we couldn't have done that. That kind of safety precaution would have ruined my business, or that would have been unfeasible. Again, feasibility is not desirability. It simply couldn't be done. Wouldn't have worked. So, again, to the extent the defendant at some later point actually used that precaution, then you can say that's relevant to the issue of feasibility, again, where it's been contested. And then the final sort of catch-all is that the defendant has somehow raised the issue himself through, testifying about it, or has made some claim for which this is appropriate impeachment. But simply the fact that the defendant, in effect, admits guilt by running out and doing the thing which you allege they should have done before the accident, that won't get in the door unless the defendant somehow puts it in issue. Yeah. Okay, there's a couple of things. The first thing would be, when does strict liability apply? Strict liability does apply to animals either ferocious by nature, lions and tigers and bears, oh my, or animals that are capable of being docile but turn out to be ferocious. A dog that has bitten someone, or you otherwise know, is so that can create strict liability once the owner is aware of that nature, or the animal by their definition is of this class. Then the plaintiff doesn't have to prove negligence. Alternatively, if that doesn't apply, you may still apply a rule of negligence. So I may own a horse, for example, and be negligent in allowing the horse to get outside and gets involved in a car accident, hits this horse that's out on the road. I'm not strictly liable for the horse. The horse doesn't bite anybody, but I may be negligent in my care for the horse. And then finally, there may be the statutory provision that imposes on owners of certain kinds of animals. So, for example, some Western states have stock rules that say basically if your livestock, cattle or sheep or horses for that matter, get out on the highway, you're liable for them under certain circumstances. So again, the legislature may create some rule that forms makes strict liability in some area. But you may also simply have an ordinary negligence case. An owner of this kind of animal, exercising reasonable care would make sure they don't get in a place where they're likely to do harm. Yeah.
What's that statutory rule aspect of animals, would that be negligence? Because it could be...
It depends on the way the statute is written. And again, if I'm the plaintiff, I'm going to see if I can find in the legislation a legislative intent to make a form of strict liability. Yeah, and again, the question is, in what form is the statute written? Does it say that owners of stock who allow their stock to get on the highway are liable for the injuries that they cause? That's a form of strict liability. By contrast, if it says owners of livestock it's a misdemeanor to fail to build, you know, everyone who owns livestock should have a fence, must have a fence at least 6 feet high and blah, 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 in between there, you know, you make up rules in the same form of keep a safe distance, don't, you know, signal before you make a turn, allow the other traffic, you know, the right of way when you're blah, 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 blah. Rules which essentially tell you what to do, but don't impose liability for a particular activity. So again, look at the statute and the way it's written to see what burden it imposes. Does it simply tell you what to do? Like don't travel at night without a light on your buggy? Or does it actually create liability to say people who do this are subject to liability for harm that results from that activity? Yeah. Well, there's no reason that you have to choose. I mean, here again, one of the things that you should expect to find in the exam, and if you go back and look at past exams, it's not so much, well, this is a case in which I put all my eggs in this basket, but rather that you kind of consider a variety of different potential approaches, both different arguments as to how you'd establish negligence, as well as potentially basing recovery on strict liability. So, in part, I think you would, as with other potential approaches to liability, you'd simply assess how strong is the case. You know, for example, for abnormally dangerous activity, is it likely I could meet the criteria for something that you know, if it's catastrophic, it's high degree of risk, etc. As I run through the category or the criteria, do I seem to be positive on a, you know, good number of them? And similarly, you'd want to evaluate how strong is the res ipsa claim. Do I have exclusive control here? Is this the kind of thing where it seems like that it wouldn't happen except when there's negligence? And are there other potential explanations or parties whose fingers are in this pie where the defendant is likely to be able to say, gee, res ipsa doesn't really apply here. So, and sometimes, again, if the thought occurs to you, gee, I wonder if this would run under res ipsa, that's probably a good indicator to you to at least discuss it. And one of the things I think as you find yourself developing a good exam technique, without it turning into just a stream of consciousness, if you've made this kind of inventory, here are the things that pop into my head, rather than going through them and saying, well, I wouldn't do this and I wouldn't do that, to some extent you can think out loud and say, with respect to res ipsa, here are the elements of res ipsa, and then you apply them, and then you reach your conclusion. It may be somewhat different from what you thought it was going to be in the beginning. I often find that I thought I knew the answer to this, but once I walk through the criteria, I discover, gee, there's a flaw I hadn't thought about, or this is actually stronger than I thought. at first glance, it appeared I couldn't meet this criterion, but then I thought about it and said, well, no, wait a minute. I might be able to do this thing over here. So to some extent, thinking out loud as you walk through these things is a perfectly good way to do it. It's potentially dangerous, but if you can't figure it out right off the top of your head, it may be a good reason why you want to have it in your inventory. Another sort of medical analogy, if you have a physical exam, the record of the physical exam, I remember seeing one of these where it's negative, 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 and you think, this is a waste of paper or a waste of good pencil lead. You know, why don't you just tell me the stuff that you found that was abnormal? And basically negative meant nothing abnormal here. But one of the reasons for doing that is to actually make a record that I check these things. You know, if I simply have a physical exam, only abnormality found was such and so, you might assume that, well, all this other stuff was checked. But when you actually have a record that says, you know, lungs were normal, that shows you you've actually been through this process. So as it turns out, when you're practicing law and you evaluate things, and then 6 months later you pick the file up again, or somebody says, hey, I got a call from Mrs. So-and-so, and she said you weren't interested in her case, but she went to another lawyer, and the lawyer's, you know, all hot to trot and thought we were a bunch of dinglings because we didn't, you know, and you can't remember Mrs. Smith off the top of your head, but you go back in the file and you look at, this is why, you know, based on what she told us, it, you know, here was my analysis of it. So having that kind of record of, I thought about this, but that isn't going to work. I thought about that, well, we might try this, but it would depend on this, and I do, you know, so forth. So again, it's a balancing process. I don't want to say, you know, Mr. DeWolf, if you were pregnant, you know, but on the other hand, you know, there's some useless information, but on the other hand, saying, well, there's no strict liability here because there are no animals involved, there are no, you know, it's not abnormally dangerous, and there's no property rights, so I don't see a basis for strict liability. Just going through that and rejecting, now let's talk about negligence, you can dispose of it fairly quickly and have a record that you've thought about it, rather than the only thing you ever talk about is negligence, and you can't tell from looking at the paper whether you even thought about strict liability. And I'll bet you for every time you do that, a significant number of times you'll say, well, there's no strict liability. No, wait a minute. You know, there's a, you know, as you start to explain why you're doing something, you realize you haven't thought the whole thing through, and you'll come up with stuff that turns out to be, gee, I'm glad I actually went through that exercise because I thought about stuff that that slipped past me the first time. Yes. Here's the, I think that the standard is essentially when you begin the exam, you have a blank slate. Now, if you want to spend a few minutes just kind of, you know, with a brain dump, you know, I'm going to just write out essentially the table of contents from chapter one, 15 items here, and gee, the 2 or 3 minutes it takes to just scratch that out like a shopping list will remind me I actually know something, and, you know, be kind of, if that works for you, that's fine. But I think for everybody's sake, it's important that when the exam actually starts, everybody's got a blank, you know, screen. Everybody's got a blank sheet of paper. So. Yeah.
The voice or I mean the audience are then
yes.
To what extent are they going to be the big picture things like hospitaling and injury prevention?
Yeah, they're not interested in that big a picture from the standpoint that's important to us as lawyers to kind of see can we find similarities, commonalities, etc. We can talk about Posner, whether Posner's right or wrong, but to the extent that that philosophy has come down into more bite-sized, this is the way we do it now, that's the part that I would focus on. And again, to the extent that something like cost spreading or injury prevention would become a factor in deciding whether to impose strict liability, if we're out at the edges of, you know, the six criteria from the restatement and in a tough case, how we're going to balance all these things. But in an hour mini exam, your ability to get to that level, again, part of the exam process is what you're being tested on in the exam is dealing with a hopelessly large task in a manageable space of time, because lawyers are constantly figuring out, you know, what do I have to put on the back burner so I can take care of this thing now, the tyranny, the urgent over the important, and all that kind of stuff. So to the extent that you manage the process of really talking about the things that you think are going to be most helpful to your client, if you've still got time left over and you want to, you know, do other stuff, that's great, but most of the time you find that the time you have in the exam is really well overcommitted to, you know, reading the problem, rereading the problem, you know, rereading your exam. So you write stuff out and then you go back and you reread it and you discover to your dismay that, you know, it doesn't say quite what you wanted it to say. You said defendant when you meant plaintiff, and, you know, stuff like that, again, you're typically, as I say, overcommitted with other stuff, so the theory and the philosophizing sort of gets short. Yeah. It's better not to get to that point. I mean, again, I would say that this is where, you know, part of sort of job one is you'll find there are some things that seem almost ridiculously easy. Probably not as many as you would like to be ridiculously, but to the extent, for example, that you look at the sample answer to an exam and it's not like this thing jumps out at the page and man, this a Nobel Prize for this for sure, you know. But what's difficult about it is doing it in that pressurized environment. So kind of making sure that you don't run out of time. If necessary, kind of truncating things a little the first go-around. In fact, you know, one of the things I really urge people to do is to, you know, if you're it's easy to do if you're typing it, to go back and modify things. But to achieve the same result when you do it with the blue book, you know, use only one side of the page, write on this side, and leave yourself fairly generous margins, double space it. So you go back and you think, ooh, I need to say a little bit more about res ipsa over here. It's easy to stick, you know, and, you know, some courts have said blah, 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 blah. You're talking about negligence per se. You say some jurisdictions don't recognize the, you know, Cardozo hard version. Some say it's just evidence of negligence. So there are these additional sort of qualifiers that you're well advised to kind of, in effect, hit the highlights the first time around, make sure you have enough time to get all the way through it, then go back and beef it up with stuff. Now, a little bit like, I'm full of analogies, you know, if you're using a plane on a door and you're trying to take the wood off, you want to ideally adjust it. You don't want to have it so thin that you're not really getting much off each time you do it, but you don't want it so thick that I can't even get the thing across the edge of the door. I want to kind of experiment until I have sort of the most I can get each time I shove the thing across. Similarly, that's one of these, as you practice doing this exam and other exams, get to the point where you have a pretty good sense of timing of how I can, you know, if it's a 50-minute or 55-minute exam, how I can really finish it in about 45 minutes, leaving me 10 minutes if I've, you know, miscalculated a little bit. I won't wind up in that situation where I'm left at the end with five issues I really want to talk about, but I've only got 5 minutes left, and the best I can do is kind of scratch out something. The reason outlining doesn't do me much good is I assume you can remember all the terms, but the key thing is, do you understand them? Can you really apply them? Can you make good judgments about them? And that's all in the subtlety of expressing yourself. So, as I say, in some ways more important than memorizing every last, you know, fare thee well of the material is getting good at your writing style and I would say the other key thing about exams is being in a reasonably relaxed frame of mind. I mean, there are a significant number of students that are just freaked out. They walk into the exam room and they're wheels are sort of spinning 2 inches above the pavement, and their mind's going a million miles an hour, and they just can't get traction. And I think that tends to be reduced the more you've rehearsed something, the more you've practiced it, and to some extent, you have to sort of spend some time figuring out whatever your mental or spiritual, emotional discipline is to be relaxed so that you're not just a bundle of nervous energy. And again, that's worth as much in terms of the quality of your exam performance as 3 hours of reading your notes over again. Going to a movie the night before, getting, you know, good night's rest and that sort of thing. Although that tends to be really hard. I know myself, if I've got some big thing I'm expecting to do, it's hard for me to get a good night's sleep the night before. But that's as important to me, doing well, as the physical or, you know, substantive preparation. So again, the learning process here is not just the learning process about the elements of race ipsa. It's a learning process about the ability to take on these challenges and meet them. And if you're doing well at that, the substance kind of almost takes care of itself. And the other way around, if you're feeling good about the substance, you're more likely to look forward to it with a healthy kind of anticipation rather than kind of dreading it. Yeah. I'm glad you reminded me, because I still have to figure out. I think we're actually going to, the people who write it will be in 143, use Blue Books. The people who use the examinator software will be in, what do they call it? Soft Test. Yeah, the company used to be called Examinator. So I forgot about the Arnold Schwarzenegger connection, but it'll be in the Moot Courtroom. So, we fortunately have a nice, large facilities. How many people are thinking about using Soft Test? And by the way, my advice on that, for what it's worth, is if you use the keyboard, by all means, use the keyboard in the exam. If you're used to writing stuff out by hand, write stuff out by hand. It's harder to make the transition, particularly with all the, you know, extra stress of the exam. You should be doing something that's pretty comfortable for you. Other questions about? All right, we'll see you tomorrow then.